On the 14th day of April of 1935, there struck the worst of dust storms that ever filled the sky. You could see.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Karen Russell, author of the new novel, The Antidote, from Knopf. The Antidote is Karen's sixth book of fiction, following the story collections Orange World, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, and Vampires in the Lemon Grove. The novella Sleep Donation, and her debut novel, Swamplandia, one of the New York Times' 10 best books of 2011, and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. She's the recipient of both a MacArthur Fellowship and a Guggenheim Fellowship, and received two National Magazine Awards for Fiction, the Shirley Jackson Award, the 2023 Bottari Latte Scrinzane Prize, and the 2024 Mary McCarthy Award, among other honors. She also serves on the board of Street Books, a mobile library for the houseless here in Portland. In addition to being a great writer, Karen's one of the kindest and most caring people I've ever met. Please join us for our conversation with Karen Russell, which is already in progress. Karen, I'm so happy you're here. We first talked for your story collection, Orange World, in May 2019, and many times since then on and off the mic. And you shared updates on the novel you were working on, how challenging it was to write, how long it was taking. Well, I have it here now in my hands, and I'm in awe of how good it is. But you must feel a great sense of relief. That's 16 years in the making.
I feel a tremendous sense of relief. And also, it's very surreal that you really did read it and that it's sitting here on the table, Ken. I really did get the idea for this when I was finishing my first novel in 2009, and I tried and failed to write it several times. I went through a valley of the shadow where I thought I was a story writer, you know, and novels just weren't something that I would try to write again. And so I guess that's the silver lining, is just the fact that it exists feels like tremendously relieving and surprising.
Yeah, but you were so productive during that time. Two story collections, a novella, numerous works of fiction and nonfiction, also dance and musical theater production, The Night Falls. And all that time, even though you put the book aside, it was calling you back?
Yeah, we were speaking about hauntings, and I was entirely haunted by this book for a long time. And thank you for that catalog. It's funny, I do sort of feel like aware that, you know, I have written story collections and this shorter, you know, a short novel or novella. But a lot of the press so far has sort of been like, you know, second novel after 14, whatever, you know, to over a decade hiatus.
Yeah,
and it sort of makes me feel like I came out of a coma or something, you know. I was like, wait, I've been around. I've been doing some verbs, you know.
Well, those were pretty good books, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, Orange World. Well, even the musical production, which I haven't seen, but I wish I could.
Oh, thanks,
I think it just
Ken.
Played in one location for a while. But hopefully it was videoed, or we'll get to see it. Now, I'd like to start from the beginning. There was this great profile on you recently in Poets and Writers by Brian Gresko. And I looked that up. He's been covering you
forever,
15 years. And he says in the profile, according to you, the book was born in a single image of a woman holding, quote, a sparkling emerald green horn to her ear. Mm-hmm. Did that image just appear to you?
It did. I mean, and it's hard to totally, this is so long ago now, but I was finishing my first novel, Swamplandia, and I just did, I got this idea of, but it really was, it was really an image of a woman holding one of these antique ear horns. I mean, people, I realize from talking about this book that no one knows what that is, but
I've seen these funnels in old movies, right? You see that in movies of the 30s and
40s. Right.
What was
exactly.
that again, young
it,
man?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It looks almost like a gramophone horn or like some beautiful, you know, metal seashell or something. And somebody was whispering a secret into this, and I was like, oh, I see. Like, she's like a human vault. She's like a memory bank. This person's whispering something that they really can't bear to remember, and it's going to funnel into her body, and she'll store it there for this person. So that was sort of the
wow, all that from that one
seed.
Image.
I think I knew it would be about like a collapse of memory, right? Like these women, I call them prairie witches who store memories for people. I'm not sure what to say about that, Ken. As you know, I like just love to literalize these things that are very abstract. So sleep donation people, you know, there's a nightmare contagion. People could donate dreams to one another. I think maybe being a fiction writer sort of predisposes you to think about memories and dreams in this way because you are always materially exchanging them with readers. You know, like writing and reading feels very much like a transfer of memory between bodies, right? Or a transfer of dream.
Oh, exactly. And in some ways, you as the writer are like the prairie witch, the vault.
A little bit, right. And I do, I mean, there was something at some earlier stage I was very excited about. I had this idea I would have like a whole chapter just of deposits, you know, the things that people, you know, came one day. And there are some little fragments, but as always happens.
Maybe in the paperback. Kind of like when Sleep Donation was re-released in a print edition, had a whole section on nightmares.
I love Lincoln and the Bardo, you know, and I sort of feel an affinity with George. And I imagine like we both were trying, you know, he has this sort of whole anthology of ghosts. I think like this chapter of deposits really was more like a short story collection, you know, that doesn't really belong
in appendix, this novel.
Yeah, perhaps, right? But I'm so interested. I was so interested in kind of those private transmissions, right? You know, what those secrets might be. And that shadow history, you know, I think everybody has one. I mean, there's the stuff that we know how to talk about out loud and the stories we pass down within our families. Or, I mean, when I get together with my family, it's almost like when people are like maintaining trails here, you know, we tell the same stories over and over again. It just feels like clearing brush from a trail.
And then there's the stories nobody wants to hear anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. There's the little archipelago and then there's some vast ocean of sort of unspeakable things.
Now, the novel takes place in Nebraska, spring 1935, during the Dust Bowl days of the Great Depression. And this period in American history makes an appearance in several of your stories, Karen. The tornado farmer and the prospectors from Orange World. And even in Swamplandia, there's a ghost, young dredgeman from that era. What fascinates you about that Dust Bowl era, the Great Depression, mid-30s?
Wow. It's a pleasure to talk to somebody who has done that deep dive. I mean, I so appreciate that thorough reading. And it's true. I think that period has haunted me for a while. That would be the bridge that I can identify between my first novel and this one. You know, my grandfather worked for the Civilian Conservation Corps. My grandmother worked for the Works Progress Administration during the Depression. So there's like a little bit, it's right on the edge of like living memory for our family that time. I think, you know, in Swamplandia, it's this colonial campaign through the swamp and this notion of nature as this waste, right? Like we're going to drain the swamp and reveal some American Eden of, you know, this endless, eternal growing season. And then...
Oh, that's taken from your book. You had an actual railroad ad.
Absolutely,
that described this fictional town of Uz, Nebraska as an American Eden. I think where the wheat grows like gold and water always follows the plow.
Exactly. So there's a similar pitch being made to newcomers to the Plains States, right? Yeah. Rain follows the plow. I mean, these like really fantastical claims turn this soil right into, there's, you know, pictures of buxom women like with like strangely louche farming implements, you know, like throwing, you know, gold coins in the air. I mean, it's both comic and tragic, right? Because I think the reality was very distant from what is advertised. And, you know, these railroads needed new customers. So sometimes they would recruit people, you know, to kind of come out and live in these kind of new settlements and towns. And you will find, too, some advertisements that say free Indian land.
Yes.
So it's not like this was a secret. Right, the Severalty Act. I mean, a lot of these federal land policies, which are truly designed as a kind of land grab for these, you know, millions of acres held communally by Native nations. So right after the Civil War, there's sort of like a transfer. There's a lot of momentum behind carving up the Western, what become the Western states.
Yeah, there was another antecedent in your work, Proving Up, a story which appeared in Vampires in the Lemon Grove. And that was a similar setting, the Nebraska prairie, but it took place in the 1870s with white homesteaders. So your research on the Great Plains was extensive. In that poets and writers profile, you say the more you learned, the more you discovered how much history had been kept from you, and so many Americans, and I'm quoting, deliberately hidden like a murdered body buried over a century ago in desiccated guilt and shame.
Yeah.
And that hidden history, was that the history of the white settlers coming in and displacing the Native Americans from that land?
I think there's like a really...
Among others.
Absolutely, yeah. A long, painfully fraught history. You know, in Florida, people don't think of it always as a frontier, right? But there's a similar, you know, history in my home state. So I think what became apparent to me as I wrote forward was how these two books were really connected at the root. And I mean, thinking about your question, why is this period fascinating? There's something about what is revealed during the Great Depression in that collapse, you know, about, you know, the sickness in some of these systems. And I think the fantasy that can really cover over real histories is one way I've been thinking about it. You know, Florida, my home state, fantasy is the big industry.
Yes, well, even in old movies like the Marx Brothers Coconuts, there was a big, getting people from the East to come down and buy land.
Right.
And it turned out to be swampland.
Right, and that's really true.
Quick buck by
absolutely.
The realtors.
I mean, truly, my grandfather owned some acres of swampland, right? And then we would like tease him about this. But I mean, those land scams, you know, there are echoes of them, right? I was writing this book, Swamplandia, when there were waves of foreclosures, you know, in 2008, this another great kind of boom bust cycle and collapse. And you see who has the means to rebuild and who gets really blown off the map, right? This is, I think, a little bit connected to those hidden histories too. When I was really young, our family's home was destroyed during Hurricane Andrew. And so I think the Dust Bowl as a story felt resonant to me, just like in my, you know, on a cellular level, because I remembered how everybody was sort of existed under the hammer of this same weather that really leveled the city. And then it was an early education in like, okay, who has the means to rebuild? Where does the FEMA money flow? Who has insurance, right? Who can continue to exist in this place and who gets swept away, you know, quite literally. And that does feel like the story of the Dust Bowl too. And then I think what was interesting to me, you know, I was really taught this history in a pretty narrow partitioned way. So I knew about the Jodes from, you know, Steinbeck's masterpiece, The Grapes of Wrath. I knew Migrant Mother, you know, a lot of these photographs from the farm securities.
Oh, you mentioned there's even a photographer, a fictional one in here, but she works with famous photographers like Dorothea Lange and Arthur Rothstein.
Yes, Gordon Parks, Walker Evans. They're sort of the real life inspiration for this character, Cleo. And she's sent out by this really incredible project, actually, like this, you know, this government-funded photography project. Yes,
yeah.
It's the Resettlement Administration, later the Farm Securities Administration. And they have this division that is sort of initially charged with making propaganda, really, for these relief programs. You know, the New Deal is quite controversial. And so they're going out to show the need for and the success of these, like, kind of rehabilitation programs, you know, the AAA, you know, other aid that's kind of flowing to both the urban and rural poor. But they receive in the early days these shooting scripts. So it's almost, you know, they're sent to find a very particular story. And I think there's always
poor
this tension.
White people. Right.
Yes, that would be.
They didn't want to offend the Southern Democrats who FDR needed to pass
right.
the New Deal program.
Right. And I mean, there is correspondence too where you'll see he's saying, yeah, take pictures of everybody, but let's lay the emphasis on, you know, yes, these white farmers, because that those photographs are more likely to be circulated. So there is real diversity in the file, but there's also this sort of shadow archive of hole-punched images. It's not always clear what the rationale was. You know, this gentleman who ran the photography project, Roy Stryker.
So he's a real
He's a
person,
real person, although this is a totally fictional character.
Right.
Yes, very, yeah, I think.
So the Stryker estate should not sue.
Yeah, exactly. Like, thanks for helping me to avoid costly litigation. But I loved having a way to kind of think and feel through how my own understanding of this period was so narrow and really curated in many ways by, you know, forces that were invisible to me when I was a younger person. And one thing that started to feel, I mean, just clear as day as I wrote on was the connection between you know, the attempted genocide and ethnocide and dispossession of Native nations and this ecological catastrophe. But that wasn't how I had grown up thinking about it, right? I knew the story of the Jodes, and I didn't connect it to these earlier waves of, you know, to the colonial violence that is still a driver of our global soil erosion crisis.
So with the Prairie Witch, where she's taking in people's bad memories and secrets so they can forget it, and she just stores them for a time when they might come back and want their deposit back, and so they can go to sleep at night and not be haunted by nightmares because they're relieved of these men.
Or chest pain, right? Or bad gas, you know, all the ways that the past can really, like, you know, show up in your body.
Right. But I thought it was brilliant, though, the way that you do this on kind of the microcosmic level. With individuals relieving themselves of these hidden histories, these secrets, these bad memories. And really, it's what the whole country has been doing maybe as long as we've existed as an independent country.
I really think that, I mean, that's something I think fiction can do that's harder to do. Yeah, there's no way to study that, right? If you're in the social sciences, you can't. I mean, there's no way to tally it in statistics what that sort of these private omissions or the lies, you know, the way that self-deceit can, or the way you editorialize your own life, the stories passed on in families, how kind of in aggregate this really can become like a mass denial, right? Or you can, and
yes,
I think—
Yes, so you personalized it in here with the individual.
It's and hard, then, right, to sort of see that as, I mean, I was even thinking about the way people are so ashamed of debt, right? And you're sort of trained in this country anyway, or like we have this winner-take-all economy. So if you're failing, I think there's a lot of shame. You might not be able to conceptualize how your own private shames are responsible for propping up a really awful status quo, right? You know, harm is done and harms endured can both become secret and occulted in a body. I mean, this is, you know, my dad was a Navy veteran of the Vietnam War, and I have often thought about veterans who come home from these wars, and they're carrying this secret cargo that is so enormous, you know?
And that's the PTSD.
It's so enormous.
They probably love to be relieved of that.
The war is still going on for my dad. Yeah. He's 82, you know? And yeah, exactly. I think I have had experiences where if I could avail myself of a Prairie Witch and just tear out a few pages of my life story,
I think everybody would,
yes. Right? It's hard to know what to do. I mean, even just privately with you know, but I do sort of think not knowing how to collectively reckon with sort of this history. And it's, you know, I've been speaking a lot about the millions of acres that were, you know, stripped from Native nations. But also, you know, when you think about the stolen labor of African Americans, that's part of this story.
Yeah, what a history we have.
Right. And so that's sort of when that horror story you mentioned, Proving Up, this is like a horror story about the Homestead Act. And that's such a... That I think the way that it was taught to me again is like amazing. Suddenly people can prove up on their land, people who have never owned land, like widows, formerly enslaved people, you know, the poorest, you know, former peasants from European countries. You can come and you can claim your 160 acres and have a piece of the American dream. And of course, that contract is sort of poisoned in many ways from the start. It's really not enough land to make a go of things in this arid region. And it's also, it's land that belonged to other families. So kind of thinking and feeling through the complexity of that history was sort of part of this project too.
And it was going on for these 16 years. I remember talking with you, for Orange World. And we even talked about the novel in progress then. So that was six years ago.
Oh my God.
And I listened back to it and you said going back to the book was like getting locked out of your house and trying to break back in.
Oh, it did feel that way.
And then,
but I don't think I successfully reentered the house at that time.
Oh, no, you didn't. But you were telling me the difficulty of completing the book, especially figuring out the ending. And I remember at one point, and it wasn't too long ago, you went on a retreat in Washington State.
I did.
To try to work it out. And I'm wondering, what was the breakthrough? Or should I say the break in?
Wow, I love that. I did. I went to my student B. Crook's house. Thank you, B., if you're listening to this, on Bainbridge Island, which was like a lovely place. And it was, yeah, it was really helpful. My, you know, my kids were so small then. My daughter was about to turn 3. Yeah, it was interesting to be away for that period. It sort of felt like, you know, when you see birds flocking together, I just feel like I came back into range of my own thinking a little bit. But I don't, and I think I did write a very rough version of this, the ending here. But it's interesting. Like, I think Tony, my husband, is a brilliant editor, and he really helped me. I had what now is the very last lines of this book were in a different place. And so I'm very grateful to him. You know,
well, he moved them around.
I think he felt like this was actually the cord to hold at the end. And I'm grateful. So, I mean, I can't even begin to enumerate the number of people that helped me. Like, I've never felt, I mean, it really took a village, Ken. Like, I don't think if I found my way back into the house, I had like 16 people boosting me from different angles, you know, to like shimmy through the window. Like, I really needed a lot of help of all kinds to write this book. And people shared really generously with me. It makes me nervous in a new way sometimes to do these kinds of interviews, because I feel such a responsibility to like the real people who this is, like, you know, this isn't distant history at all. I mean, this is some people's family history. You know, I'm really treading into times that are very much alive. So it's a new obligation, I guess, that I feel. And
I want to talk about some of those times. So going back to the Dust Bowl era, The Antidote itself is bookended by two real historical events. The book starts on Black Sunday, which is this devastating dust storm. It occurred on April 14th, 1935. And it ends about 6 weeks later with the flooding of the Republican River. That was May 30th, 1935. It rained 24 inches, killing hundreds of people, destroying thousands of acres of farmland. Why those two events? And it's interesting because they're both weather extremes.
Yeah.
Here's this, the results of a terrible drought. And then here's this terrible rain of flooding the river and damaging.
Right. That initially seems like the answer to prayers, right? Like, oh, thank God, like rain has come.
And then God, enough. This... You know,
Right, right. We've got it. I mean, and part of the reason that flooding was so tragic is, you know, that the earth was so parched. This was just hardpan. It couldn't really absorb, you know, this deluge. I was thinking about, I loved your interview with Justin, our beloved friend who wrote brilliant reboot. You know, in that book where he talks about the storm of the century of the week. And I feel like, right, somehow that weather that does, it should feel really extreme, and it doesn't seem so unfamiliar to many people anymore, I'm sure, living in 2025, you know, because we're seeing things that used to feel, you know, this is the storm of the century or the fire of the century happening.
He had sinkholes swallowing up whole buildings in Florida.
And sort of, so something about grappling with the bill coming due truly now, right? You know, but this, it's not just our generation, you know, who's facing this. And I think that when I learned how close together those events occurred, it felt like the right bookend for this story. And it sort of follows the emotional trajectory without spoilers, right? But I think the flood felt, you know, for all kinds of reasons, like the place that this book wanted to land.
Oh, it's just perfect with those two events. And of course, those start and end the book. And you set the book, though, in a fictional town, Uz, Nebraska, in 1935. So that's UZ. And there are many details based in the actual history of that time and place. But since it's a Karen Russell book, there are elements of the supernatural. That includes not just the main premise of storing memories with the Prairie Witch, but also a quantum camera that takes photos of the past and possible futures, and a sentient scarecrow in there. Now, you gave a talk, I look back because it was in the Poets and Writers article. You gave a talk at Tin House in 2012.
Thousands of years ago.
It seems that way. And it was called Engineering Impossible Architectures. And you mentioned what you call the Kansas Oz, OZ, not UZ, shuffle. Can you explain that and how that plays a part in the book and, I guess, balancing the historical elements with the supernatural ones?
Yeah, I was shocked to see that the scarecrow is that old, you know, or that I had conceived of these characters so long ago. And I bet that's encouraging and discouraging for other writers out there. I mean, yeah, the last time we spoke, I had a little baby inside me. And I will say that gestational process was much more straightforward.
Yeah, that was for
and
our
short.
World.
I mean, relatively super short. Yeah, like a human baby comes on a real regular clock. And books do their own strange thing.
Yeah, you know, 9 months, not 16
years. No, I was like in some negative trimester, or negative integer trimester. You know, I think I really needed a lot of, I think about this kind of ratio all the time, right? If you're going to make something fantastic, if you want to make some alteration to kind of the laws of nature, sort of what is the purpose of that? And also, how do you go about doing that? And I think like making a world that feels credible to another reader takes a lot of craft. And then making a place where people, you know, making a character that anybody cares about, like there's a kind of magic to that, you know, like that transfer of caring.
Yeah, that's interesting because I'm looking at The Wizard of Oz now. So you have the Scarecrow, the Tin Woodsman, the Cowardly Lion, they're imaginary, but we can all relate to their desires for intelligence, love, courage. And as with Dorothy, who is imaginary but more real than the other characters, a place to call home, which we all desire.
Oh, everybody.
Being the people we love.
Yes. Them. And isn't that, I mean, for me, that's sort of some of the ache in this book is that is the most primal, the most natural thing to yearn for, right? A place to call home.
And to be with people we love and who love us.
To be with people we love, right? Like when I had this conceit of this quantum camera that can kind of take pictures across the planes of time. So, you know, seems to be able to make photographs of things that happened, you know, yesterday, 500 years ago, in some possible tomorrow. What I liked about that or what that sort of speculative conceit let me do was try to draw into my own imagination, you know, draw into focus futures that were not apocalyptic. I will say, like, it has become, like, entirely too easy for me at 4 a.m., to jump from 2025 to some future hell world. It takes like no effort, right? You just extrapolate from what we're doing now and from business as usual.
I think that's an epidemic across the U.S.
It's a real epidemic.
The 4 a.m.
Yes.
blues or whatever.
And it's a real indictment of how we're living, right? Because we can all get there so easily, right? It feels so credible. And it just started to feel really necessary to me and still does that more of us kind of create and hold a vision of this world we want to see. What it would look like and make it as vivid, more plausible than the fortress world, the Mad Max world, right? The scalded, dying world, right?
And everybody needs hope.
Everybody needs hope. And I think just even practically, I'm like, we need a destination. We need to be able to see it and see ourselves in it. You know, people need to be able to see a role for themselves in that beautiful story. And that takes, it just is harder, right? It was harder. It was a challenge of writing this book. But that is something that, if you know, to your question about like, well, what can realism do? And then what can some of these more speculative or fantastical elements or conceits do? I think it changes the lighting a little, right? It lets me see sort of beyond my own ego or even my own lifetime. And that camera would be a good example of that ratio we were describing. You know, I didn't know anything about photography, really. I didn't know about darkroom processing. So my friend, the photographer Andrew Moore, who took this incredible photograph that I wrote a story based on it, the tornado auction. It just looks like a giant cyclone inside a sale barn. He took the exposure speed was not what he had thought. He made some mistake and it yielded this like sublime photograph. It looks like, yeah, like a cyclone opening up. It's like the only framed art in my house that children didn't make. And but it was like all these black Angus cattle running in a circle. And there's just something about the way the exposure worked made it look like a weather event.
Yeah, Andrew and I, this was about a year or two ago. We were in San Francisco. We saw an Ansel Adams exhibit. And he was saying, or at least, you know, in the guides that we had, that the negative contains all these dimensions and worlds.
Yeah.
And the developer is really, say you have like a Beethoven symphony, the score, when it's developed, it's just an orchestra performing it in their own way, in their own interpretation. But there's so much more in the score or the negative in this case.
I just love that analogy. Yeah. And so I think that darkroom process, I think there are also, it felt analogous to just writing a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's always a surprise to me, right? And this photographer is just continuously bewildered to see that whatever she kind of framed up in her in her ground glass is just not what she captured, right?
Yeah, with her magic camera.
And so that, yeah, so it's a very mysterious collaboration with this camera, right? And with the developing process. But I wanted that to feel rooted in reality, so I really needed Andrew's help. I really needed to know, you know, well, how would the fixing bath work? Or what, you know, what do the shadows on the wall look like with this kind of safe light? Things like that. You know, I wanted to make that as precise as possible.
Yeah, and you have her developing in the root cellar of the bachelor farmer's ranch or farm.
Right, and I needed help from farmers. I needed help from, I mean, because these weren't worlds that I really knew. And it felt really important to be precise and accurate about, you know, the rules of this reality. So when I did make an alteration, right, when you do kind of have a woman who houses other people's memories in this kind of very physical way, right, or when you have a camera that can take a picture of something that happened half a century ago.
Or a novel by a brilliant writer.
I think
it works in the same way, though.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, we might have talked about this before, Ken, but just that Flannery O'Connor quote, the truth is not distorted here, but a distortion is used to get at truth.
Yes.
And I think I give Cleo some line that's sort of her version of that, right? Where she's like, everybody is making alterations of nature to make the invisible apparent. And that's what she feels like she's doing too. She has this kind of cross exchange with the fictional Roy Stryker, where she's saying, you know, documentary photographers are artists too, right?
Oh, and he doesn't believe they are. Yeah, it's not art to him.
There's some debate about that. Yeah. Right, right.
Again, it's the fictional Roy Stryker saying that, not the real one. Real one.
Yeah, he actually had tremendous respect for his photographers. And I think there was tension, right? Because people don't love to have hole punches shot through their negatives.
Yes, that was an interesting point, but that actually happened.
It did actually happen.
The negatives he didn't like, didn't think were up to his guidelines and the objectives of pleasing the people in Washington, he just punched a hole in.
Right.
So it was forever ruined. Or you would develop it with a hole.
And it's so interesting to think about those, these sort of the futures, you know, the future memories that we don't receive, you know, as a public, because they're not... Right, they're destroyed before we can see them. And then later he abandons this practice and things do become more collaborative, you know, down the line. But in the beginning, in the early days, it was exactly that. He would put a hole punch through duplicates, right? Sometimes I think there was an aesthetic reason. He would just choose the stronger image. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, although the rationale is not spelled out always, right, you get the sense it might be a political calculation. It's hard to totally know. So I don't want to write speculative fiction about the real Roy Stryker's, you know, rationale for that decision. But there's a shadow archive now online. If people want to go to the Library of Congress, you can see
some of those
hundreds
photos.
Of thousands of photos. But you can also see all of the hole punched and unpublished negatives.
And you publish a few, you print a few in the book.
I did, right. Just to kind of give a sense of that project.
With and without the hole punches.
Right, right. And so I thought there was something moving to me about that archive is also now available to people. And I did find myself, I mean, I guess that sounds pretty, I don't mean to sound glib about it, but I really do find myself thinking that we need to tell fuller stories about the many histories in this country. One thing that I found myself thinking about a lot is, you know, both proving up the story we mentioned in this novel are set on Pawnee homelands in Nebraska. And the Pawnees are sort of forced because of white settler aggression to leave their like millennial home in the Central Plains and move to a very small reservation.
Oh, right. Did you want to talk about that? Because we had talked before we sat down to the mic about one of your sources, a member of the Pawnee Nation, James Riding In. He's also a professor at Arizona State and I think set up an American Indian Studies program there.
He did.
And he was extremely helpful. I think, did you show him the manuscript? And he said, you got some things wrong here. Come with me. That kind of thing.
Well, I didn't show him the manuscript. I mean, down the line I did. But I cold called him. I had read a piece of his in Native Historians Write Back about the case of Yellow Sun. People can find this online if they're curious. And I found it really helped me to write a section set in the 1870s.
The Pawnees were removed from the land in Nebraska in 1876, or they were all gone by 1876, and they were forcibly moved to reservations in Oklahoma.
And I think what I was struck by was how near to the Dust Bowl that history is, right? I mean, this is not it doesn't, you know, the 1930s, just one generation, two generations later, you had these apocalyptic dust clouds swallowing the sky, and the epicenter of the Dust Bowl catastrophe is Oklahoma, right? So I was really struck by that, right? That wasn't a part of the story that I knew, right, or that I connected.
So you actually went out there and he toured the lands with you?
Yes, but it took a couple years. I mean, We spoke for years, like conversations on the phone. I spoke with his niece, who's become a friend, Electa Hare. I'll get to talk to her on book tour, too. She is part of the Pawnee Seed Preservation Project. So they collaborate with Nebraska farmers. They're growing Pawnee corn, this, you know, again, on Pawnee lands in Nebraska. So I think I wouldn't have been able to write this book truly without help from a lot of sources. And I think James and Electa and others really pooled their, you know, visions and knowledge with mine. I was so grateful.
And he wrote a land lost acknowledgement, which was included in the book.
Yes. I really wanted to bridge from this fictional, you know, from this fiction to sort of some sense of the real history. And I thought it, you know, I'm so grateful to James for working with me on that. It's powerful coming from his perspective.
Should we talk about your other source too, Karen? Brock Anderson. He's another Native American resource. I got him down here as a Lakota, Nebraska historian. And he introduced you to a true story. A baby who at 4 months old was one of the few survivors of the Wounded Knee Massacre. Her name's Nkala Nuni, also known as Lost Bird. And she's a real person. Can you tell us about Lost Bird, how you integrated her into the book? And I read her history, and you even mentioned in the book, there's even a Portland connection.
There's a Portland connection.
She used to take the streetcar to the Oaks Park amusement park. Oaks amusement park.
So if you're a Portlander and you've ever been roller skating there, the woman known to many as Lost Bird, she loved to go and it was like honky tonk and roller skating, and I forget myself how old Oaks is, right?
Like yes, but that was one of the bright moments in her life. She had a very sad life.
She did, I was really grateful. Brock helped me so much with this particular section of the book that's set at an unwed mother's home in Milford. And James, you know, later I went with him and his family on a road trip through Nebraska. A lot of the book had been written, but it was powerful to me to go to some of these places that, you know, kind of exist in some fictionalized form in this book. The Milford home was a really tragic place. It was illegal for women to have babies out of wedlock. It was, I think, originally conceived of as a sanctuary, you know, for women who didn't have resources. But you could also be sentenced by the courts to a year's confinement.
Lost Bird actually lost her baby at the Milford home, but she was still had to stay there to serve out a one-year sentence.
Yes, and I thought that
even
was...
Even in her grief.
Yeah, one of the cruelest things that I learned about researching this book was that these women who their babies might miscarry, you know, the day after they arrived at this place, and they would still have to stay to complete their year's sentence. And it was, I think the horror story for me with this institution was just kind of thinking through how a charitable impulse, right? Maybe you go and you think, I really want to help these destitute women, these teen moms, and somehow the outcome, right? It's like this is a carceral logic. So there were straitjackets that,
and solitary confinement.
Solitary
including
confinement.
Lost Bird was in historically, she was confined to solitary, which is awful punishment.
It was devastating to learn about this. And I think, you know, it's a work of fiction. So, you know, the women, you know, the antidote, this prairie witch, the backstory I had imagined for her was that her baby was taken from her at this institution.
They told her the baby
in the early
died.
Days. Yeah, right. These places were designed to facilitate adoptions, you know. So I think, you know, I'm sure there were women who, you know, where some of these adoptions were voluntary, but I have to assume that the context in which this was happening, you know, that there was coercion also. So I think a lot of these sort of witches that I'm imagining, like the space that gets dynamited through them is from some cataclysmic loss. And it is just an open wound. And that's actually what they're renting out to people. They're renting out, they're renting that out as sort of storage space for other people's memories. They're absorbing them right into their bodies. So that was sort of I had already kind of set the story at this particular home in Milford. And I spoke to Brock and he told me just taught me about the logic of some of these progressive era institutions. And
so this amazing coincidence of synchronicity where you already had set the story there, you had the prairie witch
at
there.
And then you found
out that Tsinkala Lostbird was also there at that home. And then you integrated her into the story.
I did. And I spoke to many people kind of about that decision, and I still feel, I think where I landed, you know, having many conversations with people, I really didn't want to participate in the further distortion or erasure of the woman known as Lost Bird, but nor do I want to suggest that the character in this novel is this woman, right, who has living relatives and who means so much to so many people. So I just, you know, yeah, just holding all of the complexity of that,
but
right?
You also expose her story, or
I think it's important for people to know.
Yeah, so I was so interested. I went and looked her up.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that she was a real figure, and she is, with this whole story of how she was adopted or actually kidnapped.
She was kidnapped by a general and
his wife, and lived in Portland for a while, and then the general wanted her back, and she was pregnant apparently by the general, I guess.
There's some speculation
about that.
He's the one who
he's not a good guy, and there was kind of bad secret there.
No, and I learned, you know, I didn't know, Andrew Jackson has a really similar history. You know, he massacres a village and then sort of steals a baby and calls that his adopted son. So, but it's sort of a war trophy, and that, as far as I understand, is how General Colby thought of this baby who is an infant survivor of the Wounded Knee Massacre. I think one of the assumptions I had, right, reading about these institutions, I think, you know, her story and the story of other women, it's often relayed as a tragedy, and of course it is that. And there's not that much known. You know, I couldn't actually find out all that much about other women who spent a year at Milford. But I would just assume that they are so much more than the worst things that happen to them, you know? I mean, I hope that this novel can bring that to life too, you know, sort of like, I would just assume there was friendship and laughter in these places, right? Like, you think about the life wish
of
people who endured.
Well, you show some of that. You have the prairie witch, Tony, who's 15 years old at the time. They escape momentarily and all go roller skating in a barn. Or
I wanted there to be a night of total freedom, total pleasure.
And
right?
Then, of course, they have to pay for it later, unfortunately.
Yes, and but that felt so important to me because I think you don't want. Yeah, there is real tragedy here, but I also hope. Right, when I was thinking about my own experience of writing this book, was that I cold called strangers asking for help, and then a couple years later was visiting with them and their families, right? You know, was driving like on Country Road Z, you know, like singing to the radio, was, you know, like sending, you know, car. I mean, I wound up speaking to a great diversity of people doing all kinds of different work. Mimi Castile here in Salem, Oregon, who I really think will save the world. Like, I mean, sure, what she knows about, she's like a soil seer, and she's trying to kind of change global agriculture while there's still time. And she really believes that soil is the best way that we can mitigate the effects of climate change. I learned so much from her, but she was another stranger who I just sort of cold called. So I guess like something happens inside the book where these people are united in this mystery, and they do sort of become friends. They become this chosen family. I mean, I don't know, Ken, not to embarrass you on your own show, but we met, you know, half a decade ago, and like you're such a dear friend of our family now. So that has just continuously been my experience.
I think we bonded over the Wizard of Oz, ironically enough.
But yeah, I mean, I guess like that possibility too of like real friendship. And you see how something like the reservation system is designed to break that, or these invisible lines that we draw around our lives and police with blood red force. Really, one of the tragedies of that for me is that you miss out on the possibility of like a real sustained kind of friendship.
And that's what happens. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that kind of this family forms that's not blood related so much.
Right.
The lead, the narrator certainly.
This sort of unlikely, in the most unlikely way. My friend Kaveh Akbar helped me so much also with this book. You know, the version that I sold, between the version that I sold and the version that was published, I think he read it twice and gave me amazing editorial notes. And he had this great quote about how, you know, this, at the heart of this book is the vast, inexpressible ache of American gratitude, which feels true to me. But he was also saying, you know, like, these people are all united in this one mystery. How interesting that their destinies start to crisscross. And I mean, I think they are also kind of bewildered by what's happening to them. You know, Cleo, the photographer we mentioned, she almost gets, she, there's some kind of rear window ethics that she finds herself dealing with, right? I mean, I, if I were in her position, I don't think I'd be thrilled, right? Like, I mean, she is just meant to kind of pass through town and take a few photos.
Yeah, and the rear window comes through her magic camera, actually.
Now
she discovers a crime.
Right. And I think all of these characters in different ways are presented with some new responsibility that feels totally overwhelming and would be overwhelming if they were up
acting
against
alone.
Yeah.
Right. And they show it a tremendous act of bravery during the course of the book that no single person would probably undertake.
Nobody
on their own.
Could do it alone,
no.
Right? And I think that, as obvious as that sounds, viscerally, that was a real lesson for me of writing this book.
Now, another thing I want to talk about, and we talked about this again before the interview, which I should have recorded. I love the way you set up the symmetry in the book with the white settlers kind of kicking out, or being the reason for kicking out, the Native Americans, like the Pawnee Nation, who were on that land. But some of the settlers, including Harp, who's the bachelor father in the book, the Tin Man, in effect, counterpart, he's from Polish, a family of Polish immigrants. And then Tony, the Prairie Witch, is from a family of Italian, Sicilian immigrants. What you set up in the book is that they're kicked out of their lands for a number of reasons. With the Polish, there was the German concept of Lebensraum, which the Germans wanted more living room, is what it means literally. And they had to flee Poland or die. And they came to America. And they had to kick out the Native Americans to get to their land. And then Toni, she left Sicily probably because of poverty and other reasons. And she ends up here too. So it's kind of this German Lebensraum is very similar to the U.S. Manifest Destiny at the time, just with a different cast.
Right, right. I think that was part of the tragedy for me too. And I was reading a lot about this Polish ethnic cleansing that is occurring, you know, in Prussian Poland and, you know, what becomes the part of the German Empire. And I mean, there are, you know, they too were forbidden from speaking their language, from practicing their religion. There was a real push to Germanize the Poles, you know, and some of the rhetoric, it just, it's so similar to the way that
there's definitely, reflections of what's happening, resonance of what's happening to us now.
Absolutely.
Though you probably couldn't have even conceived of that when you were writing the book, how bad it's been.
No, I mean, that is, there have been beautiful surprises and some really agonizing and, you know, enraging surprises for me, kind of studying some of this history.
And then your personal history, you were telling me too, part of the family's from Poland, part from Italy.
They are, right. And so I was thinking a lot about these people who are fleeing real persecution and find themselves in the role of colonizer in America and what you would have to exile from kind of your waking consciousness, how you would have to kind of, what you'd have to deny, you know, or distort to be able to make this new life in this place. And I think this person in the novel, you know, he just keeps asking, well, what was I supposed to do, right? You know, what choice did I have? I think I myself have probably said those very words in my life, right? You know, sort of that howl of
rationalizing something terrible.
Yes, and such an ache, right? Like, what? Like, I don't think that this person kind of wishes to be in what turns out to be a kind of American horror story, right? And there are other cases where people are, if you read newspapers, you'll see there are plenty of people who are just hungry for land, overtly so, right? And there is a lot of greed. And, you know, I think James Reiningen was very clear with me, and I appreciated this. He was like, when you speak about this history, there's a real temptation to say it was the U.S. government, right? But this was happening with the full participation of settlers, and they wanted our land, you know? So...
Well, that was a scene in the Milford home where Toni, who's there pregnant, so many bad things are happening, but she says something like, better them than me.
Yeah.
So it becomes kind of a self-preservation and whatever you have to do to kind of rationalize that so you don't feel like a total villain.
So, yeah, and I think that refrain sort of, that's usually how it works. I'm like the last to know, you know, and I just notice like when I reread a draft, I'm like, oh, I keep repeating, you know, I wrote that straight.
Better this, them
the
than go, me.
The Ghost Birds has its own sort of version of that, this refrain, and that it's always instructive to start when something like that starts to accumulate meaning. And it sounds probably simplistic or reductive, but I do think that that is the fear that gets installed in many people, right? It's sort of, I think there's a lot of fear today also, right? And it's like, I might lose, I might have even less, right? There's still more to lose. Even more might be taken from me. It's not safe to extend my circle of compassion.
That was another line in the book, wasn't it, about as much as you lose?
Yes, there's always
more to
lose.
You could lose a whole lot more.
And I think a lot, I mean, I'm really struck, you know, we have more than enough. And I'm frequently confronted when I struggle to be generous, like by the fear that comes up and sort of like this engineered precarity. I think even if you are, you know, soaking in privilege, you can still feel in our economy, you know, like, oh my gosh, what, you know, we don't, things that could be basic rights are luxuries here for many people, right? Like education, healthcare, you know.
That we've taken for granted, I guess.
Yeah. And so I found myself thinking a little bit about, you know, if we were to take that question that I think is familiar to a lot of people, like what choice do I have? I feel like howling that myself sometimes and just shift the tense. You know, I really felt that as I wrote what that would open up if it was like, well, what choices do we have? It's a really good question if it's intoned as a question, you know, and not a justification or a self-exoneration.
Like, what choice did I have? I had to do that.
What choice do I have? Right. If you were really sincerely asking, what choice do I have? And maybe, as I mentioned, right, like, it is true if you're just an individual, it can be really hard. You know, we were speaking about the pain of being born into a contest that you did not design. But trying to recover some sense of agency, you know, was part of the project of this book for me, like really trying to feel into, well, no, we do have choices here. And we do have power, you know, and it ripples outward and it builds and it's collective, right?
And you have characters we get to know who do make that decision and they do have choice and that choice does have an effect. They get results.
I read about, while I was researching this book, a farmer, Art Tandera, who lived on land that the Keystone Pipeline wanted to, they wanted it to go through his land. And he was like the one person who didn't want to sell off, right? They made it really attractive and it made it a deal you can't turn down, right? And he said, no, I'm not, no. He was able to sort of stand up, but it happened because the Ponca Nation, he had sort of made friends in the Ponca Nation and he deeded some of his land back to them and they sort of grow Ponca corn on this land. And it's a beautiful story if people want to read about the Tandrups and their gift to the Ponca Nation. But it's sort of interesting. It became sort of the site also of protests against the Keystone Pipeline. And I was just thinking, you know, there are examples where you can really see
one person making
that power and not right and or more people, right? Or like, you know, new friends and new alliances forming and standing up to things that would otherwise feel inevitable, right?
Well, speaking of team play, there's something, because I have a personal interest in it, is the basketball.
Oh, yeah.
In the book. And Adele, who's
Oh, Ken, you're a big fan. I'm nervous because...
Well, no, you did such a good job.
I also needed some editorial help there.
Yes. And you got it from your husband, Tony, and son, Oscar. Huh?
Yeah, they were
the
great.
Basketball. Yeah, so she's actually playing high school girls basketball, and they're playing for the championship. Their coach is gone, so Dell takes over the coaching. So several of the girls are gone, and the other ones, boy, they barely get to the place where they're supposed to play the championship. She's driving this bus they call Bedwetter because it leaks oil through this terrible dust storm, but they actually get there, and I shouldn't give anything away, whether they win or not. But I looked it up because it seemed like another Karen Russell invention, that this girl
would
basketball
be this
team.
This feral girls team. Yeah,
but then I saw this book, Dust Bowl Girls, the inspiring story of the team that barnstormed its way to basketball glory.
Yes.
By a woman whose dad was apparently a coach then.
Lydia Reeder. Yes. Thank you, Lydia.
But that book came out in 2017. So how did it find its way
in
a book that you had been working on since 2009?
I mean, this is so humbling, but I remember when that book came out, Algonquin put it out. And I was like, this is the answer to prayer. I had been writing about this girl's basketball team. And I was like, oh, my God, it's a sign. Like, I'm really on the right track. And then that ended up being.
Wow, so the girl's basketball team just came to you?
I was already writing about a feral girl's basketball team. But then that book came out. And it helped me greatly. And everyone should read it. It's really wonderful and joyful to read about these young women playing, you know, men's ball in the
1930s. Yeah, and she talks about Babe Didrikson, which Dale idolizes in the book. I didn't know she was a basketball player, but she did. She had a team called the Barnstorming Reds.
Yes.
I think I knew her as a famous women golfer.
Oh, wow.
So she must have been like a Jim Thorpe, you know, just an athlete good at everything.
Right. Well, it was fun to, you know, I mean, some of these quotes are from historical sources. So one is like someone saying, well, female basketball is a freak show. You know, who's ever going to watch it? And then Caitlin Clark, as I was putting the final touches on this manuscript, you know, Caitlin Clark was having her ascent. So that was sort of fun to have a kind of rebuke to that person in the 30s.
Oh, what a difference she made. Yeah.
Yeah. Tony said that Dell was like Chris Paul. That was his comp.
Oh, the point guard?
Yeah. I played very badly, but I did play girls basketball. And my best friend was an incredible basketball player. And I know Dell, I guess it was a debt to my best friend in Miami. But she's much angrier. she is like a little bit like a Captain Ahab, right? I mean, I really love this character. And she's very monomaniacal in her pursuit of victory. I mean, this is like her coping mechanism. Her mother's been murdered. She's really the only alive to play basketball, she says. So she does end up maybe losing perspective a little and driving her team like, you know,
you make to that hell clear. And again, I don't want to say what happens at the championship game, but
it's kind of a Pyrrhic victory. Yeah.
Dell learns a lesson.
Yeah.
She has a good heart and she knows some of that obsession about winning.
Oh, I'm glad I really loved her. And I also, I mean, all of these characters, I mean, the Prairie Witch and Dell both are pretty morally compromised. So, but in ways that I relate to, I mean, I couldn't have written these characters if I didn't have my own experiential reference for some of what they're up against.
Well, speaking of that, I have one last question, which that totally relates to. Harp, the bachelor farm in the book, these four main characters are narrating sections from their point of view.
Oh, yeah.
So there's Dale, the teenage girl, Harp, her uncle, who she lives with, Cleo, the photographer, and Tony, the prairie witch, the antidote, the title character, along with the scarecrow and the cat at times. They're not as major characters, but they're fun. And Harp, is, in his section, says of Cleo, who's the photographer with the quantum magic camera, quote, she's always asking from behind her camera, who wants to be seen? What wants to be known? And I'm thinking there's got to be some affinity between Cleo and the book's author, who's asking the same questions. And in your book, Karen, in The Antidote, providing a few answers.
Oh, thank you so much, Ken. That's a beautiful reading. Yeah, those were sort of my guiding questions, and I was continuously surprised by what the answers seemed to be. You know, I think that was, as I mentioned, I mean, so many real people shared parts of their real history.
But it was
me.
You who was mining that hidden history. You also have an affinity to the Prairie Witch in that I texted you after I read it, and I said, I can't imagine what you felt like taking in all these tragic events, this real history, a lot of it hidden from us, and living with that, and just being able to live and not explode. I mean, kind of like the Prairie Witch, but in her case, she wasn't really aware of the memories and the secrets she was taking in. But in yours, you were fully aware.
No,
hyper
they just
aware.
Kind of sink under the waterline. Well, I'll say too. You know, I think one of the most powerful parts of writing this, the last photograph in this book, was taken by James Riding, and it's a defunct federal Indian boarding school, which were really these kind of places where Native children were strategically attacked, they're government funded, and it's, you know, these these students were forbidden to speak their languages. Sometimes they lived hundreds of miles away from their homes and their families. They were forbidden to practice their religious spiritual beliefs. I mean, these are extraordinarily cruel places. So it's this, this boarding school on the Pawnee Reservation, and next to it is this recently constructed earth lodge or mud lodge. And I would say that that was really incredible to me, because this story is set in the 30s. A lot of the pictures are from that period or even earlier. I wish it could be in full color, right? But the last picture is like from 2023, and it's of this earth lodge that was, you know, just finished, and this shuttered school. And really, James in his caption writes, this symbolizes the Pawnee people's endurance, right? Their ability to outlast harmful federal policies of ethnocide and genocide, you know, and it's...
And retain their identity.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I visited sort of restored, you know, places where prairie, the intact prairie still existed, was being restored, and places where memory is being restored, these digital reconciliation projects, right? Where it's sort of filling in some of the holes in our understanding of this period. So I think... I mean, there were some real horrors, but it was very hopeful to me, too, because I met a lot of people who in different ways are all about this work of kind of healing and justice and restoration. There's another photo that, you know, somebody digitally restored some of the holes punched through the photographs, you know, and that really stood in for me. You know, there's certainly a lot of work to be done, but it's underway also. And so I think that was part of the story too, people's courage, right? The life wish of people that is so powerful that, you know, gets them through some of these
horrors,
right? But there's also like laughter, right? Like in the Valley of the Shadow, like there's a lot of belly laughter, it turns out, you know?
Well, I can't imagine a Karen Russell piece of fiction without a lot of laughs.
No, and we all have these quantum cameras, right? We all have these imaginations that can really see anything. They have long timelines. And yeah, that's what fiction has always been for me, a good reminder that what if is such a subversive, powerful question. And we all have those cameras, right, installed in us from birth.
That's how I want to close.
Okay.
With a quote from the book. But first, again, I have to say it was so great talking. I've been looking forward to this for a long time, and it just makes me so happy. And I'm not exaggerating. This book is... one of the greatest novels I've ever read, almost like a multicultural Grapes of Wrath, but I mean, with the Karen Russell touch to it. So I just can't recommend it highly enough. But this was in your author's notes, and you were referring to Cleo's magic quantum camera. Quote, if the antidote has taught me anything, it's that I cannot imagine a future alone. The lens cap is off. The camera is pointing at the horizon. So much remains to be seen.
Thank you so much, Ken. Mm-hmm. Everybody should come on Ken's show and befriend him. I really recommend it.
Oh, thank you so much, Karen. Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show or would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Karen Russell, author of the new novel, The Antidote, from Knopf. Karen will be launching the book at Powell's City of Books in conversation with Emily Chenoweth on Tuesday, March 11th at 7 p.m. Then she's on the road for stops on the West Coast, East Coast, and multiple cities in between. You can learn more about Karen, the new book, and all her upcoming events online at KarenRussellAuthor.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, March 13th. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
but the winds still blow and the sun still bakes the land. We must practice control and conservation if we are to save the rest of the grass. The rains will come again. The plow will dig again. Another decade of reckless use, and the grasslands will truly be the great American desert.